Welcome to the Woodridge Baptist Church Podcast. For more information about what's happening in the life of our church, visit our website at www.woodridge.org. Enjoy the podcast.
Where we go. Here we go. Wow. Jeez. This is amazing. Amazing how fast this has gone as we've gone through 20 chapters of Revelation. Today we'll be in Revelation 21. It'll be an exciting journey as we look at the new heaven and the new earth, the holy city known as the New Jerusalem. It'll be so exciting. I mean, I can barely even just contain myself how this is good. Maybe it's because we only have one more chapter after this. So it's a good chapter. What we'll see is what we've seen actually through this entire book of Revelation. We are coming to the end, of course, but it's also coming to the culmination of what God's ultimate plan for the world has been, pointing to a renewed or new creation, something that has been, I believe, hoped for and planned for since what we know from the first two chapters of Genesis related to what God had intended his creation to be before the fall in Genesis 3. This is where we're now with this renewed creation. This new hope is a place where evil and rebellion will not be able to exist or remain. So it's an exciting time. We have slogged and seen so many crazy things. You're going to see some crazy things today, but not on the evil side. We've seen a lot of evil, crazy things along the way, and now we're going to see some really kind of crazy things that aren't evil but are ultimately good. We're going to get introduced to what they refer to as the New Jerusalem. Please don't take that as a geographical location. Some people do. I don't. It could be. I don't think it is. But because that's not what John's intention was, it doesn't seem. And the early church fathers didn't really see it that way either. It's kind of more of a more modern day construct. Well, with a lot of things that go on with people try to figure out Revelation is modern day constructs related to the amillennial, premillennial, postmillennial, and a lot of the more literal isms that are pulled from Revelation was not what John had intended. When we look at the New Jerusalem, like I said, which we'll be talking about today, we're given a picture of existence where people live in close communion with God, with this glory of this new existence of all destruction in the past lies now in the shadow of creation, and all evil and death is past. So that's what he is pointing to when he speaks of the New Jerusalem. It is now God dwelling amongst his people as he intended to dwell amongst his people, as he did when he was with the people we refer to as Adam and Eve, that same sort of existence and community is what we're looking at here. Here on earth, the earth that God created. So this earth is not going to go away. It's a recreation of the heaven and earth. A lot of times people like to think that I got my passport stamped to heaven, hallelujah, amen, I am on my way, and I'll never have to be on this blue marble again. And that's not, well, first of all, it's never, not in the Bible how that works. There is the resurrection in that second life, and that resurrection is part of the new creation. So this planet in which some of you may not like is the planet which we will all exist for eternity. Of course, it'll be as a new creation. So that's the fun part here. I know a lot of other people don't believe that, and that's fine. But there's a lot who do read Revelation and the rest of the Bible in that way. So, you know, it's one of those things. We'll find out when it's all said and done. When the roll is called up yonder, we will see exactly how all that plays out at the end of the day. We had talked about the books of deeds and the book of life last week, and I guess that is the roll that will be called up yonder. So it's an interesting way to look at this as we go through Revelation. We'll start Revelation 21. I'm gonna read 1-9. It's a relatively lengthy chapter compared to some of the ones we've had recently, but it's good. It's not going to be one of these that's going to take us a long time, even though it's, I believe it's 27 verses. to get through this. But let me read 21, 1 through 9, and then, or maybe just read to 8. We'll see. Okay, so then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, or the first heaven and the first earth passed for. The first heaven and the first earth passed away, and there's no longer any sea. That's not a literal sea. We'll talk about that. And I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, made ready as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, behold, the tabernacle of God is among men, and he will dwell among them, and they shall be his people, and God himself will be among them. And he will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and there will be no longer be any death. There will no longer be any mourning or crying or pain. The first things have passed away. And in he who sits on the throne said, behold, I am making all things anew. And he said, write, for these words are faithful and true. Then he said to me, it is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. I will give to the one who thirsts from the spring of the water of life without cost. He overcomes will inherit these things, and I will be his God, and he will be my son. Kind of like, have you heard this before? I will be their God, and they will be my people. Reference to Jerusalem. But for the cowardly and unbelieving and abominable and murderers and immoral persons and sorcerers and idolaters and all liars, their part will be in the lake that burns with fire and brimstone, which is the second death. So those will be coming. There will be those who are coming to a second life. Because when you die here on your present earth, that's your first death going into life. And then you'll be alive again with the second resurrection. So I guess you have first death, you'll be heaven. So how I look at it, N.T. Wright, he'll probably, I don't know, well, I'm going to say he's going to agree with me, but hopefully I don't butcher this too much. But my understanding and what I agree with is that we will die, we'll end up in some place that we refer to as heaven, which is ultimately what is referred to as the, also known as the presence of God. We'll talk a little bit more about that here in a little bit. And then once the new creation happens that is being described here, we will go then into the second life, not the video game, and we will then exist for an eternal age, or for an age of time that may be eternal, on this new heaven and new earth, which, of course, new heaven and new earth pretty much are together at that point. There's no, right now there's a thin veil between heaven and earth. What we know as those places are dimensions, and there will not be that in the future. But then, of course, you have the second death, which, of course, is the book of life did not play out well for you. You were rebellious and sinful. We're all sinful, but mainly rebellious and unfaithful. You decided not to follow. You decided not to be a believer in God, and thus you will head off with the devil in that second death and that fire and brimstone. And it's not God's choice. It is thus your choice that happened. We'll talk more about that as well. Those are just very brief overviews. And that's the thing with what we're doing here with Revelation. There'd be no way in any sort of amount of time, unless it takes multiple years, to do a deep, deep dive into Revelation. Now, this is relatively detailed, I think, but I'm giving you a perspective that I have come up with based on a lot of the commentaries that I've read, and am coming from that direction. There will be other people who will come up with different conclusions based on what they've read. And it's just like that with many other parts of the Bible, where people will read it based on their context, based on their background, based on what denomination they may possibly be from, what they've studied in the past, their life experiences, and will come up with different interpretations. So that's similar to what you get, say, out of the letters to Timothy or in Ephesus, where you have the egalitarian complementarian idea of the role of women in the church and in the house. Some will take it as something that's considered to be a very complementarian, or that the wife has a very specific role within the house and she cannot step out of those boundaries. And then there's others where it do not have that belief. So, and they read it from the same scripture. It's the exact same verses, but interpreted differently. Sometimes you can take it as a level of convenience. It is more convenient to look at it that way. But otherwise, convenient for your life is what I mean. Not convenient as in a convenience store, but as in, let me believe that because it makes my life easier to have someone waiting on me hand and foot regularly. Okay, so verse 1, John sees the new heaven and the new earth coming down. We know that both had already fled, so that earth and heaven had already taken off. We know that from chapter 20, verse 11. So he's repeating the past in the way of the two in this verse, just kind of provide a little emphasis and reminder for those following along. We also note that he says the sea is no more. This is a reference to the sea that was before the throne of God. Some would say, I'm a little skeptical on that. I'm looking at it from a little bit different perspective, but that's some viewpoints on there. But what we have to remember about the idea or the symbolism of the sea during that time period is that sea represented chaos and rebellion. You could also think of it as the untamed part of creation, the part that would rebel against God. That's where we've had monsters such as the Leviathan and Rahab. Leviathan? Let me say that one wrong. Anyways, and Rahab, both sea monsters would come out of this, both bringing chaos into this. There's some similarities that you see in from Mesopotamia and other relatedness of the time related to the sea that really tie in closely to this. So John, what John is really good at is taking myths, histories, traditions, cultures, and being able to combine them to be able to tell this story. Of course, a lot of it coming from the Hebrew Bible, what many of us would refer to as the Old Testament, in that regard. So that's where he is able to do here. You know, throughout this study, we've talked about Ezekiel, we've talked about Enoch, we talked about Ezra, we've talked about Isaiah, Daniel. All those books are pointing to this, and John also grabs a lot of material from those books and brings them into Revelation. So in the new rebellion, in the new creation, there of course will not be a sea, because the reason there's not the idea of a sea is because there's no rebellion. That does not mean that there's not going to be an actual physical ocean. For those of you who enjoy going to the ocean for a nice dip in the waves or surf or sunning and stuff like that, it is assumed that in that regard will still be there, because it's the sea is part of God's creation, is part of the beauty of it. But to them back then, the sea was a pretty scary place because they didn't know what to do with it, because it was so massive, and they didn't have the ability to navigate it. And so there was a lot of fear from that. Again, it comes also from a lot of the mythologies of the past during that time. Just like the imagery of Satan and the beast being thrown into the fire, we're given additional symbolism regarding the sea being no more, where evil has been defeated and removed, thus the sea no longer exists. Much of what John speaks of here comes from what Isaiah told in Isaiah 65, 17 through 18, where he brings the idea of a new heaven and a new earth. So just keep that in mind. Isaiah, like I said, is referenced multiple times throughout this book. So for that, you could look at Isaiah 65. As we look at verses 2 and 3, we can see here that the New Jerusalem comes from God. John is making a point that what has been created is from God, coming from heaven. It is not like Babel, which was a human invention or a human creation. I heard the guy who did the whole Noah Arks thing, whatever that thing is. I can't remember if it was in Missouri or Arkansas. Anyways, he wants to do a Tower of Babel and have something to do with racism, to end racism. Anyways, the whole deal is, in my opinion, silly, but it's one of those things. So anyways, God creates the new heaven and the new earth. God creates the new city, Jerusalem. It is coming down from heaven, from God's creation down to earth, that new Jerusalem is. And that's why that's important, and that's why that contrasts with the human creation, which were the nations, the kings, the cities, and of course, Babel. So New Jerusalem is the centerpiece of God's new heaven and new earth. Isaiah 65 does a similar thing, linking the new heaven and the new earth with the new Jerusalem, all tying them in together. We can figure from this that John is not talking of a recreation of the city of Jerusalem. Think of it as the old Jerusalem is not abolished, but it's as if the new Jerusalem fulfills what the old Jerusalem was to do, much like the Gentiles now are to do what the Jews were not able to do. The Jews as the chosen people who are to be separate from the rest of the world, which is why we had all the Levitical laws and everything related to that, to separate them and their lifestyles, to show them as a people of God, to separate them was the purpose of that. And that is for us as well today, is that it is our us to be separate from this world, not as in we're absent from this world, but as in how we live is not as how the people of the world live in. Of course, world, I'm not talking about world creation, but I'm talking about the systems, societies, and everything related to that. That doesn't mean we're anti-systems or anti-society, but that means if there is the option for the opportunity for adultery or idolatry, we avoid those. We live a different way. We have different priorities and different ways of living. So we are now, with the New Jerusalem, fulfilling what unfortunately the old Jerusalem with the temple that God resided in, at least in a way to where he could be close to his people, did not work. God does not make all new things, but he makes all things new. So there's a big difference there. So he's not making a new heaven and new earth. He is making the heaven and earth new as a recreation of. So that's a huge difference between the two. So it's not like all of a sudden we're going to have a new earth. It's brand new. That's why it's so important for us to want to be able to take care of God's creation, which is a sometimes has for some reason become a political conversation, as in if you want to take care of the world, you're now a Democrat, which I'm not saying that everyone who comes from that perspective thinks that way, but there seems to be, at least that's what the media likes to talk about. We know the media in many ways is a little too reductionist in how they look at people. But at the same time, as people who are followers of Christ and believers of God, and that this is God's creation, because if that's what we believe, if we believe what's written in Genesis 1 and 2, and that we're to be stewards, not domineers or people who dominate, but people who are good stewards of the earth, is how it reads in Genesis, even though we've liked to perverse that into thinking that we can dominate the earth and destroy things. Because, hey, one day we're not going to be here is not how that works, because that's not what is taught, actually, or written in the Bible, even though it's a whole lot more convenient to think that way, because then we have a whole lot less responsibility and accountability by just believing the other thing. Going forward, remember the temple in Jerusalem was where God dwelt among his people. John sees a new community where God dwells among his own people, as we see in Ezekiel 37, 26 through 27. There are a couple of manuscripts that are highly regarded when it comes to people or peoples, and they will be his peoples is how it would read, or his people. It is believed that the correct the correct way of looking at this is, intended version is peoples of what God is saying here, where it says there at the end of verse 3, and they shall be his peoples. And why I'm bringing that up is that there is a universal standing or understanding that there will be many people types or many nations, nationalities all over the world. They will not just be white people from America in the new Jerusalem. So that's the part that we want to make sure we keep in mind, that all people will have access to the new Jerusalem. Verses 3 and 4, we have a voice from heaven that is not identified. The voice is to tell us the meaning and significance of what is being described. We can note here it is very relational in what is being taught. We know from here, from Ezekiel 37, that God will dwell among his people, or as we see in John 1:4 regarding Jesus, where the Word became flesh and dwelled among us. It is the desire of God to dwell. It always has been God's desire to dwell within his creation and with his people. Jesus, being here on earth, was giving the people of the earth at that time an idea of what it would be like to have God dwell with his people. And as you can see, when Jesus was around, there was a lot of healing and happiness, and there was a lot of joy, and there was hope. And so that is the idea that we're trying to look at here. God and his people. There will no longer need to have to be have prophets or other mediaries. You wouldn't have to have like a David or a Moses anymore as intermediaries who are trying to, you know, guide and be the people between God and his people. So we know that coming from the new heaven and the new earth and New Jerusalem. We know from this there will be no pain in the presence of God, so no longer will be the physical distance or emotional angst or physical pain in the presence. We will need to look at the New Jerusalem as less about a geographical location and more about the people. So think of it as the fellowship of believers. So you have these, or the fellowship of the saints, all these people who have come together, who are fellow believers in who God is. This helps us by, we can look at it being more about the people than place, in that it is referred to as a bride prepared for her husband. If you look at verse 2, it seems there is a lack of consistency here with the imagery of a city and a bride. We know literally a city cannot be a bride. I guess you could refer to a city as a bride in a female context. So it's hard to do that. Also, if the city are the people, how do they enter themselves? So that's another part of it too. If the city is actually the people groups, they can't enter within themselves. We're reading through an apocalypse here, so keep that in mind as we go through this, where it's about telling a story about imagination and creativity. So we have that with an apocalypse. Because of that, we have to allow for a lot of fluid imagery. Moving forward, right along as we go, verses 5 and 8. We now have for only the second time in this book where God speaks directly, affirming of what was said in the previous verses. John, with assurance, can write that from verse 5 that God's words are trustworthy and true. As we look into verse 6, God tells John that it is done, meaning the goal of creation has been accomplished. All things have been transformed by the power of God. And God is speaking this. We have a reference to the Alpha and the Omega telling us the one who started the process of creation has now brought creation to its consummation. So he was here at the beginning and he'll be here with us in the end, at least the end of human history. And assuming going yawn well on beyond that. The reference to the Alpha and the Omega also has some sort of contrast, it seems, with the Roman emperors. It is God's power. God is the Alpha and Omega. The Roman emperors, like Domitian at the time, really thought they were the Alpha and the Omega and that they were divine. But of course, John is helping this to push us and help us understand that it is not Domitian. And it, of course, would give hope to the people who are under the oppressive regime of Domitian. John continues to push against the beliefs and ideas that it is the Romans, and the emperors who have the power. John, with the voice of God, says that all power and might is with God. He is the initiator and the consummator of creation. Those who are the faithful believers are promised the blessings of the new Jerusalem. It is God's will, as we know from verse 7, that all people be part of the new Jerusalem, that all will be God's children. With that said, those who chose not to follow God or choose not to follow God, but instead follow the evil of the beast will be excluded from the New Jerusalem. Again, it's not God excluding them. And I know that is an easy way to say, well, I'm not going to follow God, that will throw people into a fiery furnace or a fiery pit. It's the opportunity, and everyone has the opportunity. And that's really the hard part to really understand. If you're going to work that out, not, you know, like a fire, I mean, that's a lot of symbolism there. What that really looks like, I think, is an absence of God, and which with the absence of God is evil and despair and hopelessness. So again, as we continue on, but going on with verse 8, they will be in what they refer to as a lake of fire. But let's dig into sin/vice list that John provides here, as he is specific based on his time. He mentions there in verse 8 the cowardly and unbelieving, or the faithless. Remember, throughout the entire book, John has called for the people to endure and to be faithful through this very difficult time. And so now he's calling out those who were not. And so that's why that is significant. The rewards from God are to those who did not fall into the traps of the beast. So John is being very recent in how he's writing this at this point. He's very, very focused, going back to the seven churches earlier on in Revelation, and he's talking kind of right back through that as he goes through this. Also in this context, those who are faithless and unbelieving are those who claim God but then fell away. It is not about those who are not Christian. These are about people who claim to be Christians and then denied God whenever it started getting hard. And that was something that was very hard on very much on John's heart, very much on John's concern, is why he's bringing that up here. It's not about those who are not Christians here. It is about those who are, who made the bad choice, those who became unfaithful. We have those who are unclean. Again, those who were, another word for unfaithful, as we know from chapter 3, verse 4. They have soiled their clothes, as we know from that church conversation there. Those who are fornicators have committed religious adultery by offering worship to the emperor. They're what we know as idolaters. So this idea of fornication and people saying those are sexual immorality, we know true that that's not a good thing to do, and we want to avoid that. But here, that's not what he's talking about. Here, what he's talking about is those who are part of emperor worship, those who are part of the religious cults, and those who are participating in that. The sorcerers are the ones who had tricked others to join the beast. So these are people who not necessarily were they casting black magic or casting spells. They had convinced, and they could have been using spells to do this, but they had convinced the believers, I guess the weaker believers, to turn away from God. So the understanding here is that they are the true followers of Satan by sharing this lie. They are the ones who deceived, and they are the ones who provided this deception for these people to no longer want to believe. The reason for this list is for the members of the churches, like I said, in Asia Minor at that time, to help remind them to remain faithful in this hard time, which is something that, of course, as you can imagine, when you're being oppressed and not being able to feed your family, you're looking for ways to survive. And sometimes that means that you turn to maybe not the best things, and that's what was going on, and that's what he's trying to deal with here. As we look into this next section, verse 9, I'm not sure where we all went to 27. Look at that, it's the end. let's read through 14. And I may, well, yeah, let's start there. Then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls, hey, look, they came back, full of the seven last plagues, came and spoke with me, saying, come here, I will show you the bride, the wife of the Lamb. And this is where we get introduced to the New Jerusalem. And he carried me away in the spirit to a great and high mountain, which is very symbolic, and showed me the holy city Jerusalem. It doesn't mean that the holy city of Jerusalem is on Mount Sinai. Coming down out of the heaven. It could be. I doubt it, but it could be. Let's just go there. Having the glory of God, her brilliance was like a very costly stone, as a stone of crystal clear jasper. It had a great and high wall with 12. This is great. This is such a great explanation. Great high wall with 12 gates, and at the gates 12 angels, and the names were written on them, which are the names of the 12 tribes of the sons of Israel. There are 3 gates on the east, and 3 gates on the north, and 3 gates on the south, and 3 gates on the west. And the wall of the city had 12 fountain stones, and on them were the 12 names of the 12 apostles of the Lamb. The one who spoke with me had a gold measuring rod to measure the city and its gates and its walls. Now this is very funny, because angels' measurement system, according to some people, is larger than humans. So a cubit is the idea from, I believe it's your forearm, elbow, to the end of your hand. But angels are bigger, so their cubits would be bigger. Hey, you know, it could be true. That's very interesting. Anyways, so this gold measuring rod, verse 15. Oh, let's continue on. This is fun. The city is laid out as a square, and its length is as great as its width. And he measures the city with a rod, 1,500 miles. Holy moly. Its length and width, yeah, that wouldn't fit on Mount Sinai. And height are equal. Wow. Width and height, so it's 1,500 miles tall? There's more to this. And he measured his wall 72 yards, according to human measurements, which are also angelic measurements. See? Angelic measurements. And you notice here that the wall is 72 yards tall, but the city itself is 1,500 miles tall. So that's quite a deal. I'll explain more of that, or at least my version of that. The material of the wall was jasper, and the city was pure gold, like clear glass. The foundation stones of the city were all adorned with every kind of precious stone. The first foundation stone was jasper, the second sapphire, the third chalcedony, the fourth emerald, the fifth sardonyx, the sixth sardius, the seventh crystallite. Not crystallite, chrysolite. The eighth beryl, the ninth topaz, the tenth chrysoprase, and the 11th jacinth, and the 12th amethyst. And the 12 gates were 12 pearls. Oh, the pearly gates. And each one of the gates was a single pearl, and the street of the city was pure gold like transparent glass. Can you imagine the size of that pearl? I saw no temple in it, for the Lord God Almighty and the Lamb are its temple. Because they're the ones who are dwelling. And a city has no need of the sun or the moon to shine on it, for the glory of God has illumined it, and its lamp is the Lamb. The nations will walk by its light, and the kings of the earth will bring their glory into it. What do you mean? Kings and nations, weren't they defeated in the last chapter? How is this so? in the daytime, for there will be, I'll just wrap this up, no night there. Its gates will never be closed. Why was that? And they will bring the glory and the honor of the nations into it. More nations, huh? And nothing unclean and no one who practices abomination and lying shall ever come into it, but only those whose names are written in the Lamb's Book of Life. Holy moly. That's the end of chapter 21. Of course, we're not done discussing it, but that's the end of that. Next week, we get to talk, and Jesus gets to talk in the next one. If you have the red letter Bible, you'll be able to see that. And that's really exciting. So that'll be chapter 22 next time we do this. Will probably be next week. It's 21 verses, and it is going to be a humdinger of time. Anyways, let's finish this up, the New Jerusalem. In this scene, we see a deliberate contrast between the bride, Jerusalem, and the whore, also known as Babylon or Rome. We learned about Babylon back in chapter 17, early on, verses 1 through 3. With this contrast, we get a view of the opposing natures of these two cities. So you have a contrast here of what's being explained of the New Jerusalem with how crazy and bad Babylon was. And some people would say still is. Each scene of the new city has one of the seven angels that dealt out the bowl plagues telling John to join them and see. Look, they're multifaceted people or beings. In chapter 17, John is taken to a wilderness, but in this situation, John is taken to a great high mountain. Both the wilderness and mountain, as we know, are very symbolic in their meaning. This is not about a geographical move that John made. Remember, he is in the spirit, so he's in a trance of some sort. But we know from biblical tradition that the wilderness is typically a place of temptation, disobedience, and evil. Some would also say solitude, but we're going to go with those three. At this point, many of the examples, one could be Exodus 16, 1 through 3. Mountains, on the other hand, are places of association with God and divine revelation, as we know from Genesis 22, 14. The mountain setting is pulled most likely from Ezekiel 40, verse 2. It is believed that John draws many of the elements of the scene from the chapter, from that chapter of Ezekiel 40. We could say that this place is Mount Zion, where the city will descend to. Sure, if that gives you happiness, then say it is. The city has the glory of God's brilliance because God is the source of the New Jerusalem. So absolutely. It comes down out of heaven from God, as we see in verse 10 here. Ezekiel 43:5 says it's a bit different there, where God's glory enters the new temple and fills it, while here in our current situation, the glory of God is already there. So that's the big difference. That's why there's not a temple there. There's no temple because you don't need a place for God to dwell because God is already dwelling with them. God with us. God with them at the time, with us now, because we weren't alive back then. Notice he was taken in the spirit, which is either by Holy Spirit or in the human spirit. This tells us it was not a physical experience, but some sort of state of spiritual exaltation. Let's look at the description of the city just a little bit. We don't have the time to dig into everything, but we'll dig into some of it. The brilliance of God is like jasper, similar to what we see back in chapter 4, verse 3. We have 12 gates and 12 foundation, which depicts the strength and security. And I would even say, because we like S's, the sovereignty of God. The 12 gates have the 12 tribes of Israel. Engraved on them, the 12 foundation bear the names of the 12 apostles. I assume one of those is not Judas, but the one that was named later on. The city is very inclusive as it contains all of God's people, those from the new as well as the old covenant. This is something that our Jewish friends, of which John was one, would have to be able to explain and understand, that those Gentiles that we do not like or we cannot put up with because they are not real people even, they will be in heaven too. And it's like that for us too. People that we look down upon, people that we distrust, people that we think are less than us, well, son of a gun, will most likely be with us in that life we like to call the afterlife. Another reference that we get here is from Ezekiel 40, verse 5, is a measuring rod used to measure the city. As we see here, it is a perfect cube, which is brilliant how he did that. This is symbolism of the city's measurements, because you have to think about this. We have the number 12, which of course symbolizes completeness and wholeness. We see this in the 144 cubits of the height of the wall, which is a multiple of 12, again, going back to that. The huge size of the city is not is not only awe-inspiring, but also symbolizes the enormity and completeness of the kingdom of God that comprises a great multitude, like the 140,000, that no one could count, as we see from chapter 7, verse 9. Let me look at something real quick. 1 minute. Da, 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 da. Yeah. All right. I think I said 140,000. I meant 144,000, but that's a whole other issue. We know what I mean. It's divided by or divisible of 12. Interesting of the measurement here is the city is 1,500 miles high, yet the wall is only 75 yards high, which is pretty tall in itself, but 1,500 miles, that's a whole other. Maybe that has something to do with heaven and earth coming together at that point. Verse 17 helps us see that the wall does not have to be high, as the New Jerusalem does not need protection, as, of course, all evil at this point has been defeated. Another way to look at this is not a literal way, but again, with the use of 144 tells us completeness and perfection. Moving forward, as we start looking at verses 18 through 21 here, we get a description of the city, the majestic jewels, precious metals, and glass that he uses in an attempt to overwhelm those who are listening. For those poor believers at that time to be able to understand and see this amount of precious stones and jewels and metals would be awe-inspiring and mind-blowing. So that's why John is using that here. He is using very traditional usage of these elements. The idea of the New Jerusalem and the design of city is very much like what Isaiah spoke from Isaiah 54, 11 through 12. But we also see a hymn in the book of Tobit, chapter 13, providing a similar description. So it's not new what John is coming up with here as he writes about the city, or if it was his editor at this point, because remember in chapter 20, verse 3, we've heard before that John had passed by that point and he had a he didn't do it because he was dead, but someone else had come in, most likely a scribe of his or some sort of intern or mini teacher came in and wrapped up the book. Anywho, so many side notes. We have found, there's been, I haven't personally, so I can't use we, several fragments from the Qimron community have been found, which supports what we're reading here, and it seems to come from Ezekiel chapter 40 through 48. The fragments tell of an angel guide who measures the New Jerusalem and all of its contents, so we're starting to see some consistency there with these fragments from Qimron. And I think as we see more and more research coming out of Qimron, what we're going to see is that there's going to be a lot more information about the context of that time and what people believed early on in the church, and how there are some, it's not always the same thing that we believe now, because we have more information that we're allowing us to develop our beliefs in what happened even more. We see in the fragments from Qimron aspects of the city made of gold, sapphire, rubies, alabaster, and onyx. This specific list of precious stones is most likely inspired from Exodus 28, 17 through 21, and 39, 10 through 14. These are texts that describe the breastplate that is worn by the high priest. Very similar stones. Recall that the breastplates, if you can recall, if you go back to those, had 12 precious stones with the name of each tribe inscribed on each. Some have said that John's intention here is pointing to the idea from of this book, chapter 1, verse 6, that believers are priestly people. We consume. That was implied. In this case, the 12 names on the jewels are those of the apostles, which would be very much more important to the Gentiles than to the Jews, even though it would be important to the Jews. It does not matter what the stones he is using or trying to figure out why certain jewels were picked. This is more about the beauty and brilliance and worth of the dwelling place of God. We continue the path of parallels with Ezekiel as we move forward in a New Jerusalem, but can note here that they do veer off a bit. In Ezekiel, it is all about the temple, but in John's view of the New Jerusalem, there is no temple, so there's some similarities and also some differences. Recall that the purpose of the temple was to connect the people with God. In John's view, God dwells among the people. Instead of his glory just filling the temple, it fills all of the city, which has not happened before. We also see an adaptation from Isaiah 60, 19, where there will be no need for the sun and the moon in the new creation. It'll be God's everlasting light and glory that will light creation. To take the light idea a bit further, we can see references in the New Testament to God being light and there's no darkness in his presence, as we see in 1 John 1:5 or in 1 John 2:8. The darkness is passing away and the true light is already shining. So what now seems like a dim flicker to us, because many times it feels like maybe God isn't exactly here with us, will be someday this overwhelming brilliance in the new creation. Moving on, we're wrapping up this last part here. I told you this was a pretty quick chapter. I mean, so last few verses, 24 through 27, an additional adaptation of Isaiah 60, where the prophet looks forward to a renewed and rebuilt Jerusalem. Similarly, John speaks here about kings of the earth will bring their glory to the new Jerusalem. Like I said earlier, this is quite astounding because the kings of the earth and the nations had been the bad guys throughout all this book, but now they doesn't seem to be. And also recall that the kings were destroyed in chapter 19, verses 17 through 21, and the nations were destroyed in chapter 20, verses 7 through 9. This seems to come from beliefs in the Hebrew Bible, such as in Daniel 7, that the nations, also known as the Gentiles, will come to the city and pay homage and reference to the city and the God. Remember, John is coming from a very Jewish perspective still. He is a Jew. So he's coming from a Jewish perspective. And so there was still that idea that Gentiles and Jews were separate, but Gentiles were now able to come to the Jewish God. And so that's how that would play out. And so the nations are now coming. The nations are the Gentiles, those Gentiles who want to be faithful to the Jewish God. So the question is, why is John using this tradition at this moment? Because it hasn't really been something that he's really pushed on through most of this book. Some would say that John is teaching his belief in universal salvation, where all people will enter the new Jerusalem and be part of God's people. Yay, John, I really like that. Others believe reading this new universal salvation idea into this reading is too much theology and too incidental references. To take this further is the belief that by this time, all the non-believers will be gone from the face of the earth. Based on this, the kings of the nations now refer to the people of God. So that would make sense because that would be true based on the order of this, even though we do not take Revelation in a chronological order. more would argue that both of these ideas are overstatements of what John is trying to communicate. Point one, John does hold hope that all people will be part of the kingdom of God. We see that here through verses 24 through 26, as well in other parts of Revelation like 5:13 and 11:13. I like that hope, that all people have that hope to be part of the kingdom of God. With that, he also sees that there are actions and practices that are not consistent with the belief of God, so those who insist on rejecting God will be judged. This tension of hope, promise, and warning are throughout the book. It absolutely is, and sometimes we get so caught up in the junk and the details, and is it post-A or pre-millennial, and is it a real New Jerusalem, is it a real city, and how tall are those, how tall is the city, how tall is the walls, what kind of jewels was that made out of, and all this sort of junk. All what that really does is it distracts from that this is a book of hope, and this is a book where giving to the people idea that all nations can be saved. And so the question is, can all nations be saved? All Gentiles? And the answer is yes, and that's big for the Jewish people at that time. But also the other side of the question is that can some be excluded? And the answer is yes, and this is not a Calvinistic view, but is that it is that they, not God, who excludes them. And it hurts me deep to think that there are people here, and I know the whole Calvin thing, frozen chosen, all that junk. I call it junk. Because it just is inconsistent in my view of who God is. He does not create things to just destroy them. There's not like cannon fodder. And because if all humans are created in God's image, how do you have cannon fodder? I don't get it. Here or there. I just don't see it. There's not a way to really to see that, how that works. But to each their own. That's how you want to think. More power to you. So looking at the salvation of all the people, it seems John is expressing hope that the truth within the church will be held or recognized by all the people of the world. The hope continues that God's grace and mercy will overcome the sinfulness and rebelliousness of humans. Because all people and nations will embrace the New Jerusalem as their own, through their faith in God, there is no need for the gates to be closed. That's why the gates remained open, because it's only the good people. Or, God, that's hard to say. It's only those who have put their trust and faith in God. And so what that does is that these open gates, what they do is they symbolize the safety and inclusiveness of the city. I like all these inclusive type words. From verse 27, we know that nothing unclean can enter the city, as nothing that is unclean can be close to God. That's pretty consistent throughout what we know is the Bible. So things that are spiritually unclean will remain outside the city. That is very interesting, because think all of that is already gone, but that's just interesting to see that. Maybe they will not be, I guess you could look at that as they will not be within the presence of God, because God cannot be around that. So those who are clean will be within the presence of God. Those who are not clean, those who are unbelievers, unfaithful, will not be there. So they're the ones who are unclean. So John is, what he's doing here to the people in Rome, so he's talking to the people of Rome, you can also say the people of Babylon, even though Babylon is Rome at this point, is that a radical change must be made by those who dwell in the state of Babylon. Not a geographical reference. It's those who have decided to join the beast over the lamb. It still seems that what John's hope is that those who have decided to follow the beast would still have a chance to turn and to come and follow God. And that this isn't a turn and burn thing, but this is a hope that we have, that all people will be able to exist with God. So the idea of the New Jerusalem is that it is free of evil. And now, as John is saying, it is time for the Christians of that time when he was writing this, and for us as well today, to prepare to be in the presence of God in that way, as John is trying to describe. Woo! All right. That is all she wrote for today. Not all she wrote, but all he wrote. Maybe unless John's scribe was a woman, and we're in that part at this point at the after 20, verse 3. Anyways, this is where we are, and this is where we will end today. We will start next time at chapter 22, and at that point we will wrap up the whole of Revelation, and all will be well, and all things shall be well. Have a great day. Thank you.
We hope you have enjoyed the podcast. For more information about our church, visit www.woodridge.org.